kind of comparisons?
I think what we are really seeing is the horrific consequences of a violent, exploitative, and extractive U.S. foreign policy once again, not for the first time, but once again coming home. If the United States actually cherishes the lives of these West Virginia National Guardsmen who should not have been in D.C. in the first place to backstop ICE, that's its own issue. But if the United States values their lives and values the lives of other service members and other Americans, that it has an obligation to, in the first instance, stop creating these death squads, to stop creating the conditions that are warping the people who serve in them to the point where they would commit horrific murders like these. That's a cherishing of human life that we never see from the United States in its foreign policy missions around the world.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll link to your piece. He killed for the CIA in Afghanistan. Trump blames Afghan culture instead of Langley's. And we want to thank Sean Van Diver, president of Afghan Evac, and Leila Ayoub, executive director of Project Anar. That does it for our show. I'll be in Sag Harbor on December 4th at the Hamptons Doc Film Festival. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is our KBOO Fights Back campaign. KBOO knows the importance of community media when we need it most. Help us reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Join KBOO Community Radio for an in-person meet and greet at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Stop by KBOO on Saturday, December 6th or Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Meet radio hosts and producers, members of the board of directors, and fellow KBOO community members. Enjoy coffee or tea and light refreshments, take a tour of the station, and make your year-end donation in person. For more information about KBOO Fights Back in-person events, visit kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council will consider a detention center impact fee and a change to city investment policy.
Lawmakers and advocates raise concerns that automatic license plate readers are leading to ICE arrests.
And the shooting of two National Guard members in D.C. prompts sharp immigration action by Trump.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 1st, 2025. I'm Kate Chase.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Portland City Council meets this Wednesday at 9:30 a.m., and at least two items on their agenda are likely to draw crowds. First, they'll hear a second reading of the Detention Facility Impact Fee ordinance brought by Councilors Analita Murillo and Mitch Green. If passed, it would add a new fee onto private landlords who rent their buildings out as detention facilities. Detention facilities like the ICE facility on Southwest McAdam Avenue have big impacts on the surrounding community and on the city, which has to respond to it. That includes things like police overtime, traffic management, emergency response, and environmental cleanup from chemical weapons like tear gas. The sponsors of the ordinance say their fee would help make sure it's not just Portland taxpayers that carry the burden of these facilities. The impact fee structure proposed wouldn't impact the ICE facility in Southwest Portland just yet, only in the process of a lease renegotiation or renewal. But the nuisance standards would allow the city to respond right away. In an FAQ or frequently asked question document, the councilors write that this structure is to protect against future detention facilities that could be built. At the last reading, Portlanders turned out in large numbers to weigh in. Some activists, including those with the group Portland's Contra de los Portocinianos, oppose the fee, saying it allows more detention facilities in the future instead of revoking the current facility's permit. Today, December 1st, is the deadline for the property owner of the ICE building, Stuart Lindquist, to respond to the city's land use violation notice it sent in September.
Later on in the Portland City Council agenda, the council will hear a resolution on the city's investment policy. Normally, this is an unexciting reapproval. State law requires that Oregon cities readopt their investment policy each year. Not this time. 66 people have written in with testimony, with more planning to testify in person. Most of the written testimony so far calls on the city to divest from major corporations and to create a human rights screen on the city's investments. Those kind of limitations have come up before. Portland policy already prevents investment in oil, alcohol, casinos, correctional facilities, small arms, and security services. Back in 2014, then first-term city commissioner Steve Novick led an effort to get the city to divest from Walmart based on its ethical conduct, abuse of market power, and impact on the environment. 6 of the 12 Portland city councilors have taken a pledge to ensure that Portland is not complicit in Israel's genocide. One anonymous testifier writes, quote, "I do not want my city's money to go towards human rights abuses domestically or abroad. I support a strong and expanded screening of Portland's investments," end quote. The current language for the proposal does not reference a human rights screen, instead making a minor tweaks to existing language to reflect the city government's reorganization. Portland City Council meets Wednesday at 9:30 a.m.
Oregonians have until the end of the year to benefit from energy-saving home improvements through federal tax credits. However, incentives available through Energy Trust of Oregon will be available beyond 2025, and some can be stacked with federal credits for more savings. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Federal tax credits for making energy-saving changes at home are expiring at the end of the year, but some opportunities for Oregonians to save on upgrades will remain beyond 2025. Expiring federal energy efficiency credits can save homeowners up to $3,200 on upgrades like heat pumps and insulation. Originally established to last 10 years under the Inflation Reduction Act, these and other climate incentives are ending under H.R. 1. But Jamie Seymour with Energy Trust of Oregon says its cash incentives and programs will continue regardless of federal changes.
For people who have made these upgrades this year, they can receive both the tax credit and that incentive, really stacking those savings and taking advantage of that opportunity before the end of the year.
Seymour explains Energy Trust incentives can be received as instant savings at retailers, as an upfront deduction through a vetted contractor, or as cash back after completing an upgrade. She adds upgrades like heat pumps, high-efficiency gas furnaces, and solar panels are eligible for both the expiring federal credits and ongoing Energy Trust incentives. Electric costs in Oregon have increased significantly, with residential rates for Pacific Power and PGE rising by about 50% since 2020. Seymour says insulation is one of the easiest, most cost-effective ways to lower energy use and make your home more comfortable year-round. And she says until the end of the year, it still qualifies for federal tax credits.
Adding insulation around your home can lower your heating costs by up to 20%. So that makes a really big difference when keeping your home warm during the winter.
Seymour says the federal tax credit for insulation is up to $1,200. And in addition, Energy Trust lowers the cost by $1.50 per square foot and more for families with lower incomes. She adds people can visit energytrust.org to find a vetted contractor who can do an energy assessment to see what upgrades to their home would make the most impact. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Local and national lawmakers are questioning if license plate readers are constitutional. Automatic license plate readers have been in use in the U.S. since the late 90s. They were originally used for border security, but have expanded across the country. Networks of cameras scan and record license plates, using an algorithm to flag vehicles based on where they came from, where they're going, and which route they're taking. Law enforcement agencies say that they are vital for finding suspects and generating leads. Chris Skinner is chief of police in Eugene. He testified about how these readers are used in front of the Oregon State Senate Judiciary Committee last month.
Because the technology as an industry standard practice is a crime fighting tool that all of us need in the state of Oregon. And we've seen it certainly affect our livability and our safety here in this in the city of Eugene. We had our program for just a few short months before we suspended it as a at the request of our city council, pending some further discussions and maybe a more enhanced contract with our specific vendor. In that short period of time, we saw as many as 94 incidents where we were able to make arrests. 63 or 4 of those were felony arrests here in Eugene.
Eugene and Woodburn turned off their license plate reading cameras in October due to fears they were being used for ICE raids. It's not that far-fetched. Earlier this year, authorities in Texas used license plate data stretching as far as Illinois and Washington to search for a woman believed to have self-administered an abortion. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts wrote a letter to Border Patrol's parent agency stating, quote, "Without transparency, accountability, and clear limitations, these practices erode fundamental individual rights and set a dangerous precedent for unchecked government power," unquote.
Courts have usually upheld license plate reader collections on public roads, but have condemned other kinds of technology used for mass tracking, such as GPS or cell location data. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said, quote, "As Americans across the nation hit the road this holiday season, they shouldn't have to worry that their travel might make them a target for law enforcement or open them up to undue questioning about their movements, activities, and relationships," unquote. A report from the University of Washington found that several police departments authorize their license plate data for use by U.S. Border Patrol. Kai Fireside is with Eyes Off Eugene. Fireside testified about the use of this type of data, specifically by the company Flock.
The groundwork for Flock's cooperation with federal agencies was laid early in their development. They had MOUs with fusion centers by October of 2020. In June of this year, in response to investigations of search audit logs, Flock said they removed direct access to Flock data for federal agencies. However, in August, investigators found additional evidence in search audit data that federal agencies had another kind of direct access to Flock systems at individual cities. Flock set up accounts for Customs and Border Protection agents who were able to request direct access to the Flock systems in individual cities. Because Flock's interface incentivizes data sharing, many cities accepted the requests without knowing who they were sharing data with. Again, these agencies were not aware of this data sharing.
Activists have raised concerns about Flock specifically because their database is being accessed by government agencies. DFLOC.me is an organization that tracks license plate reading cameras across the globe. They report 74 cameras in the Portland area that automatically log license plate information. The Portland Immigration Rights Coalition posted their weekly update Monday, saying they've noticed overlaps between where ICE is detaining people and where these automatic license plate readers are located. They say there is a particular concentration at Lowe's and Home Depot's in the metro area, where many day laborers find work.
The shooting of two National Guardsmen leads to sharp immigration action by the Trump administration. Nursing degrees are becoming harder to obtain, and Medicaid cuts force parents to stock up on medications. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm proud of each and every one of them. I pray for each and every one of them today, and in particular for these two young service members who are willing to go above and beyond and pay whatever price our nation asks of them.
Brigadier General Leland Blanchard says the National Guard remains committed to keeping the nation's capital safe. Two members of the West Virginia Guard were shot last week. One died and the other is still in critical condition. Afghan refugee Rahmanullah Lakhanwal has been charged with first-degree murder. Lakhanwal fought with a covert unit that reports describe as a CIA-run targeted assassination squad during the Afghanistan War. Several reports describe him as suffering profound mental health problems. According to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, he was, quote, radicalized while in the U.S., and the FBI says the shooting is being investigated as an act of terrorism. After the attack, the administration halted asylum decisions. The U.S. vets all asylum seekers, although the system faces a backlog exacerbated by cuts and policy changes. Lachlan Wall was vetted extensively when working with the CIA and had his status approved under this administration. A court has ruled against President Donald Trump's use of the National Guard for crime reduction in Washington, D.C., but he's going ahead with a deployment to Memphis. He credits the Memphis Safe Task Force with making the city safer, but Earl Fisher of the group #UpTheVote901 says crime was already declining and questions what defines success.
So if I say we go lower crime by 5%, 10%, it's going to be violent crime, it's going to be this kind of crime, it's going to be property crime. And if you just say all kind of crime, but in what amount of time? In 5 months, in 5 weeks, in 5 days, in 5 years?
A bipartisan group in Congress is questioning if top military officials committed a war crime by ordering the killing of survivors of an attack on an alleged drug boat. The Washington Post reports Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave a verbal order for everyone on the vessels to be killed. The paper says the military made a second attack on survivors after one boat in the Caribbean had already been struck. Meanwhile, a federal change would make it harder to become a nurse. The Education Department is removing nursing programs from those it says offer professional degrees, making it harder for students to get financial aid and loan forgiveness. The agency says nursing students don't need the loans. Janelle Matthews is a registered nurse at New York City's Brooklyn Hospital and also teaches nursing. She says her students are panicking.
What if they decide now that because there's no funding for their education to continue that they're going to drop out? That increases the deficit that we're already seeing at the bedside.
Some parents are bracing for looming reductions in Medicaid. Wisconsin mother Megan Lowe says she fears the $1 trillion cut planned over the next decade will jeopardize crucial care for her 17-year-old daughter, Nora, who has a rare neurological disorder. Lowe has health insurance through her husband's employer, but it doesn't come close to covering everything their daughter needs. She says they rely on Medicaid for thousands and thousands of dollars worth of medical supplies, treatments, and respite care a month.
Families that we know through our Rett syndrome network, they're stockpiling syringes and feed bags and diapers. We're just stockpiling everything because we don't know when the rug is going to be pulled out.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of about 35 degrees. Tomorrow, expect a chance of rain with a daytime high of 48. Today in history, on this date in 1955, Rosa Parks was jailed for refusing to give up her seat on a public bus to a white man, a violation of Montgomery, Alabama's racial segregation laws. Her arrest led to the Montgomery bus boycott. The quote of the day is from Parks, who said, quote, "To bring about change, you must not be afraid to take the first step. We'll fail when we fail to try."
A number of Alaskan communities were devastated by floods earlier this fall, meaning there's a lot to rebuild. Some Native Alaskans are taking a construction course to prepare to rebuild their communities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For several Southwest Alaska communities, it took one night of hurricane-force winds and floods to destroy what could take years to rebuild. How and where to begin is a question that a group of men from Kipnuk tackled at a construction workshop in Anchorage. They've been staying in the city since their village was evacuated after the October storm. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride found out, this time, instead of disaster, it was an opportunity that came knocking.
The whack of a hammer. The buzz of the saw. Those are the sounds of hope.
3 3/8 larger and 3 3/8 smaller.
They just lost their homes. They lost everything.
Tiffany Cottle is the training coordinator for Alaska Works Partnership, which offered a one-week program on how to frame a house.
I do think that this is really helping them stay positive and stay hopeful. They've all been so grateful for this training.
And they're all volunteers, like Devin Mann.
This is the door. And this one's going to be the window.
Devin looks sharp in a brand new hoodie given to him after a military cargo plane airlifted him and almost his entire community to Anchorage. He came with only the clothing he had on and feelings of trauma after a 5-mile ride in a floating house.
I thought something bad was gonna happen to the house, like break apart. I thought that would be it for us, but I almost gave up. But I had hope. I had hope.
It is hope that keeps Devin going.
Everything we're learning in here and doing, it's gonna be useful in the future for our village.
I mean, honestly, I can't stress it enough. Use your wrist.
William Andrew is impressed with his crew of trainees.
For what they went through, I'll be honest with you, their attitudes are awesome. They're wanting to learn. They've been great.
Andrew says 1 week of training in basic construction skills is not enough to learn how to rebuild a village, but it's a start.
I'm excited about their future, and I'm hoping that they get to rebuild it.
For now, there are hopes the training will lead to jobs and other opportunities. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
5 Native people are among 29 Bush Fellows to receive awards to develop leadership skills. In the 4th of 5 profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a tribal judge who wants to indigenize the bench.
Since childhood, Megan Troyer has been fascinated by the judicial system and concerned with making sure Native people receive fair and equitable treatment under the law. The daughter of a White Earth Ojibwe tribal judge and an Austrian Holocaust survivor, Troyer serves as chief judge for the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe. She has very specific goals for her Bush Fellowship.
I'm going to cut my judicial caseload in half and take Ojibwe courses for the 2 years of the fellowship. And I'm really going to make focusing on the language my top priority and try to learn as much as I possibly can. And then part of my fellowship will be going around to Indigenous scholars, spiritual leaders, and mentors that have worked in the area of.
Ultimately, Troyer says she wants to bring humanity to the judicial system. Her late mother, Margaret Troyer, was the second Native American attorney in Minnesota and was appointed as a federal magistrate in 1982, making the elder Troyer the first female Native judge in the country. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New research shows small community-led climate groups achieve significant results when granted better access to funding. From 2021 to 2025, the Northwest Climate Resilience Collaborative funded local organizations most impacted by climate change and revealed their potential to make positive change. KBOO reporter Lizard has more.
New research reveals how successful small grassroots organizations working on climate change in the Northwest can be when barriers to accessing funding are removed. From 2021 to 2025, the Northwest Climate Resilience Collaborative funded local organizations led by those most exposed to climate risks, enabling them to implement protective and adapted measures locally. Zach Thill is with the Climate Impact Group, which ran the collaborative. He says if big funders like universities and philanthropic organizations want results, the research shows that they should let frontline communities be in the driver's seat.
We try to let organizations be their authentic selves so that they could take the funding and do the critical work that they see needs to be done in their communities. Because at the end of the day, they know better than we do of what their community needs.
Phil says by removing barriers like narrow definitions of climate resilience, requiring partnerships, and complex reporting, the Northwest Climate Resilience Collaborative was able to create a competitive application process that was still accessible to small, low-capacity groups. The NCRC was terminated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration earlier this year. Although its run was short-lived, the NCRC worked with many rural and tribal communities across the Pacific Northwest. It funded a queer and trans organization that conducted research on how extreme heat, wildfire smoke, and droughts affect their communities in Washington. The group is now using that research to advocate for change with lawmakers. Another project in rural Oregon tackled nitrate pollution by providing owners of contaminated wells with drinking water, test kits, and education.
This funding unlocked all these different ways that the organization was able to interface better with their community, but also engage with relevant agencies and stakeholders that do a lot of the decision-making on these issues.
After completing projects, Phil says he was surprised that groups came back to the NCRC with more ideas for collaboration beyond funding. He says this was a result of taking the time to build trust.
That might be just sitting down, listening to them, and trying to understand what their needs are and providing that to them. before you start saying things like, let's start a project together.
For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Lizard.
Some advocates say a great way to push for a more pedestrian-friendly neighborhood is by starting with a walk audit. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Walking instead of driving helps reduce climate warming pollution. But in some areas, that's easier said than done. Broken sidewalks and busy intersections can be dangerous. And as the climate warms, pedestrians are increasingly vulnerable to extreme heat.
As we think about making safe places for people to walk, it's not only safety from cars, it's also opportunities to rest in shaded areas, access to drinking water, the kind of things that can protect us from heat illness.
Maria Wardoku is with the consulting firm Alta Planning and Design. She suggests that if you want to advocate for change, start by leading a walk audit. The idea is simple.
All it really takes is gathering people to walk together and asking them how it feels.
She says invite a diverse group of community members, including a local planner or elected official. Then take a walk together and note what you encounter. Like, are there trip hazards anywhere? Do you have to wade through puddles? Which intersections are hard to cross? Could someone in a wheelchair navigate the route? And are there long stretches without shade? Then with these insights, your group can work together to identify and push for solutions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You know, I don't have to tell you that holiday stress is real. And amid financial uncertainties this year, many families are feeling it more than ever. As Crystal Blair reports, the American Heart Association has tips on how to stay grounded and guard your peace this season.
Families are navigating tighter budgets, busy schedules, and for many, the added pressure of caring for aging loved ones with health challenges. Medical experts warn the season's emotional load can affect both mental and physical well-being. Dr. Ravi Johar, a physician with the American Heart Association, says as holiday schedules get hectic, one of the first things people sacrifice is sleep, and that's a mistake.
People usually need between 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So it's really important to get that good sleep. And it's just amazing what even just a good night's sleep will do to help you. Sometimes it's just in the middle of the day, taking a nap.
Johar says people can also reduce holiday strain by setting boundaries, such as saying no when schedules get too full. He notes the holidays can also intensify feelings of loneliness, especially for people who've lost loved ones, making it important to lean on people who truly help you recharge. For native Michigander Patty Jones, spending her first holiday season without her mother who passed in April, family and faith have become key to easing her stress.
I try to connect more with my grandkids and my kids because I lost my mom. She was a very big part of my life. I'm taking it one step at a time. You know, I lean on the Lord. That's my health and my strength.
And when it comes to your favorite holiday sweets, Johar says no one should feel guilty about enjoying seasonal treats, but in moderation. He emphasizes the heart of the holidays is being thankful and finding joy.
Think of all the things that make your life full and happy.
For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 1st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Lizard. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Crystal Blair, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kate Chase.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskell. My guest today is Brittany Van Sitters, Political and Organizing Director at the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. Brittany joins to discuss how the Environmental Protection Agency is being refashioned into the Environmental Destruction Agency, OLCV's legislative scorecard, and what we can do to push Oregon legislators to meet this moment of overlapping crises with real action. My email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. I would love to hear what you think of the show. Let's jump right in. Brittany Van Sitters, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I've been wanting to talk with Oregon League of Conservation Voters for a while. You all are a very effective advocacy organization. Can you just start us off by telling us what is OLCV? What's the mission?